Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Marek Duda from the Centre for Effective Altruism, who's going to talk to us today about effective altruism, the ideas behind it, and how they might be applied. Hello, Marek. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Can you start, Marek, by telling us a little bit about your background and how you became involved with the Centre for Effective Altruism?
Sure. So my background is actually in banking. I was working in investments, but then I heard about the idea of effective altruism through my brother initially, who was studying philosophy. So he came up against it that way. And basically, the more I read about it, the more I became convinced that effective altruism is basically really important, and that it's most likely the best way to make a difference. Now, the thing is, I wasn't actually particularly altruistically minded before I heard about effective altruism. I basically just thought that the world's problems were probably too large for me to make any difference, and also that it sort of generally wasn't really my job or my place to try and solve them. But the thing about effective altruism, which basically made me interested in being altruistic at all, was seeing the amount of difference and the sort of leverage even a single person can have on the world's largest problems. And basically that made me think, well, in that case, why not? If I can see the difference I'm making, then that's pretty great. So I decided to get involved with the movement and ended up quitting my job in banking and coming to work at the Center for Effective Altruism.
Was that an easy decision?
No. No, of course not. I certainly enjoyed my job previous to this, enjoyed it very much, but I was fairly convinced by the idea that in something like movement building, the sort of haste is actually a very important consideration, because if something is going to be growing at a particular rate, if you can contribute to it at an early stage, it'll grow that much faster, and therefore sort of if you extrapolate that growth to the future, you'll have a lot more impact now than you might do if you were to join later. So I found that fairly convincing, and I thought, why not? And I went for it.
Okay. So what is effective altruism, Marek?
Sure. So it's both a philosophy, and now it's also a social movement that is growing around that philosophy. And the main idea is simply that by applying evidence and reason to trying to solve the world's problems, you can find the ways which are the most effective at doing that. So you have the altruism, the trying to help, and the effective of looking at how to do that best and applying evidence and reason to do so.
So how is effective altruism distinguished, say, from traditional altruism or charity?
Yeah, so I guess the main way is in the motivations that people may have to act altruistically. Traditional charity people will often be motivated to get involved with that based on, somewhat of an emotional understanding of a problem, or due to being affected by it themselves. Yeah. So a fairly classical example everybody will be familiar with is donating or helping a charity that is researching a disease that somebody in your family or one of your friends has. So the difference there is that effective altruists will ask, how can I make the largest positive difference in the world? They're also emotionally motivated to try and help people, but they don't necessarily want to make the judgment of how they're going to do it based on the circumstances of their life or, chance meetings. They basically want to help as many people as possible. So regardless of whether the people affected are close or far, whether they are ever likely to meet them, they will look to donate their money or their actions to basically have the most bang for buck in terms of the actual outcomes of the interventions.
So in a sense, it's a combining of the heart and the head.
Yeah, absolutely. With the heart being what motivates you to act altruistically, but then using your head to decide where to focus your, well, obviously limited resources to make a difference, and therefore, if you use your head to decide where to put them, you should be able to find the place where they'll actually make the largest positive difference.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on cultivating the skill of critical thinking as an integrative practice in regard to this?
Yeah, sure. So basically, critical thinking is absolutely central to effective altruism. The whole idea is to think critically about how and where you can make the most difference. So this will often involve seeking out and evaluating evidence on the effectiveness of different interventions. So luckily, there are several organizations which specialize in just this. The most famous ones are an organization called GiveWell, based in San Francisco in the United States, and Giving What We Can, which is part of the center here.
Yeah.
And basically, what they do is they try to critically evaluate the evidence of what the actual outcomes are of charitable interventions. But regardless, there's, of course, some internal disagreements about the approaches to evaluating it. So also critically evaluating this, their research to form your own opinions is a very large part of effective altruism. So I think it's very central to it.
Well, can we now have a look at the guiding principles of the movement? The first one is cost effectiveness. Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So cost effectiveness, when you apply to charitable giving, is a really large part of what effective altruism is about. The idea here is that you want to find the charities where your donations will make the largest difference, will have the most sort of bang for buck. So for health interventions, this is often something that can be measured fairly well through using metrics, something like a quality adjusted life year, which a lot of aid organizations will use. Now, some charities might even fail to do good entirely, but those that do achieve good, some of them can vary by factors of 10 or even 100 times in how much good they do if you use a metric like this.
Yeah.
So if you think as an effective altruist, you want to make sure that you direct your charity donations in such a way that it has the largest impact. So an often used example for this and for this way of thinking is an example of providing a guide dog for the blind. So this is an undeniably great and very noble thing to do. But the question is it the best thing you can do with money? So even if you want to focus on the field of blindness, delivering treatments in the developing world to cure trachoma can be done for less than $20 per person. Now, to train and provide a guide dog will cost about $40,000. For that one person for the duration of their life. So if you think that helping more people is basically strictly better than helping fewer people, for the same amount of money, you could provide a blind dog for one person and improve their life. You could straight up cure over 2,000 people of blindness entirely.
Okay. That's a very utilitarian rationale for that. To be an effective altruist, is it important to follow that moral strategy?
So I don't think so, no. It's certainly the case that if you do have sort of a consequentialist or utilitarian ethical leaning, you would be very interested in effective altruism because the only goal is increasing welfare. But I think almost everybody would value what effective altruists value. So most people care about a lot of things. They'll care about freedom, relationships with their family. They'll have a sense of justice and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they'll certainly care about the welfare of others also. And they won't like to have other people suffer unnecessarily. And I think in general, if somebody has a choice of helping fewer people or helping more people with the same cost themselves, they will tend to go for helping more people. So also it turns out that the most dramatic impact you can have on people's welfare, and I'm pretty certain that is something most people care about, are through charitable giving. They are through poverty health interventions. So yeah, as long as the welfare of other people is something that you are interested in at least a little bit, it would seem that effective altruism would make sense for you too.
Okay, let's move on to the next principle, cause prioritization.
Sure. There is a general trend in nonprofits where they are starting to look on their cost effectiveness, which is good. So I think the main thing that differentiates effective altruism from this general trend is that the charities will often just compare their effectiveness within one cause area. So say, to use the example from before, so, you know, what's the most effective intervention for curing blindness in the developing world? And then, you know, you'd be able to rate the charities on how many people they cure blindness for the amount of money that they get.
Yeah.
But the choice of what you support, which cause, is often still left to a sort of, you know, do what you're passionate about or do what's or help something that's touched your life in some way. Now, effective altruists do want to consider all of the options in terms of the causes that they may have available to them. So they could research comparing the opportunities available in, say, global health, in preventing climate change, inventing new technologies, so on and so forth. And basically, we have a term which is cause neutrality. So the idea is that what you're passionate about is helping people as much as possible. And beyond that, you're not really tied to one particular way of doing it. You're quite happy to try and figure out which way is going to be the most effective and which is going to help the most people. So the cause will often be chosen based on this potential of where the potential to help the most people is, rather than choosing the area before and then maybe finding the most effective intervention within that. And so as a result of thinking that way, what many effective altruists do choose as the most important cause or area is developing world poverty and developing world health. Quite simply because charity money tends to go much further in the developing world, as evidenced by the example I was talking about earlier. So even though they may have less personal connection to that, you know, they're able to help more people, therefore they would choose that cause.
Okay. Just on that point, is there recognition that in effective altruism that if people are just simply compassionate at times without applying critical thinking, I'm thinking like an example is, you know, you go to a third world country and you go on the street and you just give sweets and money to children and, you're condemning them to a life of begging. Does effective altruism take, for example, autonomy seriously? Because often charity can be very ineffective, even though people are trying to do the right thing.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think in general, it would be quite fair to say that if you improve somebody's health, you improve their economic situation, you improve the sort of quality and prosperity of the society that they're in, something like autonomy will naturally follow. So yeah, if you cure a child of of one of the neglected tropical diseases, for example, you're very much likely to improve their life outcomes by a large amount, because they're able to stay in school, they're able to grow into economically productive adults who will have much more autonomy than if they didn't. So I think if you target your donations at stuff that that has a good evidence base, you're quite likely to avoid any of those kinds of issues.
Let's move on to the next one then, Murray.
Sure.
Impartiality.
Yeah, so I mean, this is something we've touched on a couple of times. Basically, impartiality is impartiality to who you help. So some people may say that they care more about people who live closer to them. Therefore, it might make sense to go back to the guide dog example. It might make sense to pay money towards that for somebody within your own community.
Yeah.
But effective altruists will generally hold this principle of impartiality that all people are equal, and, you know, whoever you can help, it is equal to help somebody who's near to you as it is to somebody who's far away from you. So helping any person in the world is equally valuable. And therefore, in that example, saving 2,000 people from blindness will be preferred by an effective altruist to helping one person with it, regardless of where they are geographically.
Okay. But with that, is there a recognition that, you know, intellectually that makes sense, but due to our embodied natures, psychologically that is obviously more challenging?
Yeah, that's very much the case. I think most effective altruists will admit that. They will probably admit to, I guess, almost sort of struggling with that, because a lot of the time when you help people, when you do a charitable act, you get a reward in that you have a nice sort of warm glow feeling. And whilst this is certainly the case with donating to causes that are far away, you kind of need to just think about it a little bit more to bring that about sometimes. You really need to sort of think through it and think, yes, no, I've definitely done something good. I should feel good about that. It doesn't have that immediate sort of feedback mechanism that you do when you do something very immediate, like you help somebody cross the street or something like that. That's a much more immediate sort of emotional response. But I guess the point is that those sorts of reward systems they're most likely, you know, if you look at it from an evolutionary psychology point of view, most likely evolved in order that you feel more compassion for people within your tribe or within your group. And it's not necessarily something that's actually that helpful if you really are trying to help humanity as a whole. It's something you almost have to sort of reason your way around. And then often a lot of effective altruists will do other things which might have more of that immediate reward on top of donating a certain amount to faraway causes.
Okay. And then the next one, counterfactual reasoning. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this one's a little more complicated and maybe a little bit more controversial. Nevertheless, it's very interesting. So effective altruists often will apply counterfactual reasoning to the ideas of career choice. So what sort of career should you do to have a large impact? So the basic idea of it is that you need to account for the counterfactual. So what would have happened otherwise when evaluating the effects of your actions? So the classic example to demonstrate this is, say you're arriving at the scene of an accident and you decide to go and give CPR to the victim. But the thing is that whilst you're doing that, there's a doctor in the surrounding crowd who you thus prevent from providing CPR themselves. So say you've done this and you have saved that person's life, but due to your relatively untrained CPR skills, they are permanently affected in some way. So say they're paralyzed. So you could say, sort of a naive analysis of this would be, well, I saved a person's life. That's great. And in some sense, that is certainly true. But really what you need to look at is the whole picture there. Yeah. So the counterfactual would be, well, if you did not help this person, the doctor in the crowd would have stepped in and provided higher quality CPR, and the person would not only have survived, but maybe they wouldn't have been paralyzed. So really the true effect of your action is that you paralyze somebody, you know, rather than having just saved their life. So that's, I think it's an important part of sort of evaluating your actions in a sort of more holistic and thorough way. And as I said, so if you apply this idea to career choice, so for example, with medical training positions or medical school, there's usually a fairly fixed number of positions available in any given year. Yeah. So if you go into medical school and you become a doctor and you save a number of lives throughout your career, obviously this is laudable and this is an excellent thing to do. But it would be a little bit naive to say that by the fact that you went and became a doctor and then saved, I don't know, five people a week, that wouldn't have happened to a fairly large degree anyway, because medical school admissions are very tough. And if you decided not to apply, the next best person would have gotten in, and they probably would have been at least, I don't know, 95% as good a doctor as you were. So really, the difference that you actually made, if you adjusted for the counterfactual reasoning of what would have happened anyway, is that it's actually just the difference between the skill level of, say, yourself and the next best person that could have done it.
Okay. So an example I think is often used is that then it arguably might be appropriate to work in, say, on Wall Street or in finance. Mm-hmm. But then my question there, Marek, is that would it be okay to be an effective altruist and work for a battery chicken farm where there was obviously an non-identification with a serious amount of suffering?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's very difficult. There's two ways of looking at it. One of them is, so what would have happened otherwise? What is fairly likely that somebody would have taken that job, and that somebody would probably have had less compassion for animals, say, and therefore every day in their job they would, you know, they would not be making steps or moves to try and make the suffering of the battery farm chickens somewhat smaller. They would likely just keep going in a regular way. So there's an argument to be made that you could replace somebody who would have been even worse. It's an argument. Some people are convinced by it. The other thing is, as you sort of mentioned with Wall Street, if say this particular job was incredibly well paid, so say like a consulting or a banking position, then the counterfactual is, well, somebody would have taken that job anyway. They would have made a lot of money. And if you take that job and then donate a large proportion of your earnings to an effective charity, that almost certainly wouldn't have happened. That money almost certainly wouldn't have gone to charity. So that's all sort of additional benefit. It's basically in that way that we think about this idea of earning to give, if you're able to go into a really high paying career and with the intention of donating a large proportion of your income, you're most likely making a large positive difference on what would have happened otherwise.
Okay. And then finally, the last principle is that the position of many effective altruists regarding supererogatory acts.
Sure. So basically, the idea of those is that they're acts which are morally good. Nobody's denying that it's the right thing to do. But the contention is about whether it is morally required of a typical person to do that. So Peter Singer uses an analogy called the pond analogy to explain this point. So say you pass by a pond and you see that a child is drowning in the pond, but you're also wearing your most expensive suit, and you know that if you were to jump in and save the child, that your suit would be ruined. And so you would have to replace the suit and pay £1,000 for it. So basically you're faced with the choice of saving a child's life and if you do so, you have to pay £1,000 for a new suit, or you could save that £1,000. So most people would find the person who decided not to jump in the pond to save the child, to save their suit instead, to be fairly immoral. Now, what Singer argues is that there's no real moral difference between this example say, not donating to cost-effective charity and buying an expensive suit instead, because at any given point, there are many children, so to speak, drowning in ponds across the world. And if you were to donate to a charity that could save their life, you would do so. And the fact that they're far away, or whether it's a child in a pond in front of you, shouldn't necessarily be morally relevant. So that's the idea of that. Now, personally, I think that's quite a negative way of looking at this problem, saying that you have an obligation to basically help everybody in the world all the time. So the way I'd like to spin it normally is, rather than thinking of it as a moral obligation, and as I mentioned earlier, this is sort of the thing that made me interested in charity in the first place, is that, you know, looking at it positive, hold on, I can actually make a huge difference. I can literally save lives. So that's a very positive motivation to donate. So, you know, you can't necessarily hide behind excuses of like, I can't make much difference anyway. I don't know, all the money goes to corrupt governments. There's no point doing it. If you can see solid evidence of how your giving flows through into real effects and you know, real people being cured of real illnesses, it's pretty great. And I find that quite a motivating thing for actually engaging in charity. And I think it's probably a better way to it's a better way to talk about it than to talk about moral obligation.
And it's like a sort of positive feedback loop in a sense.
Right.
Okay.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, let's move on to now to some arguments that people put against giving to charity organisations, mm-hmm. That, you know, that try to help with world poverty. So a classic one is poverty can't be solved.
Yeah. yes, it is a classic one. You hear that one a lot. So, I mean, I think the main thing is looking at the evidence and looking at the data would not seem to bear this this objection out. So basically, the percentage of the very poor as a proportion of the world's population has more than halved since 1960. Life expectancy has also improved dramatically in that time period. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, life expectancy rose by, I believe, 10 years. Whilst there's still far too much poverty in the world, it's really a big problem. The long-term trend definitely seems to be pointing in the right direction. Bill Gates recently made a prediction. He reckons that by 2035, there will be basically no poor countries left in the world. At the moment, there are about 35 countries which the World Bank classifies as low income. And he thinks that all of these will be pulled out of poverty by then. Some people may think that's too optimistic. But, certainly, the trend seems to be towards poverty being solved. It would seem likely that even if we just continue to do what we have been doing, that this will be the case.
Okay. And then some people say, well, poverty isn't the problem, it's the symptom.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Because I always wonder, what is it a symptom of? So, I mean, a lot of people will use this sort of argument to try and criticize, you know, basically start talking about politics and criticize, say free market economics or capitalism. But so my impression is that poverty seems to be a symptom of basically the human condition. I mean, humans have lived in poverty for, you know, since the start of history. And it's only really in the last few hundred years that we started to make progress on the issue and the first few people started being pulled out of poverty and then a larger and larger proportion of the human population. And sort of the trend I was talking about a second ago is fairly good proof of this. And also, so if you're saying that it's a symptom, and what you mean by that is that it's self-perpetuating, that's most probably true. Of course, society will often be stuck in that situation. But at the same time, again, referring to the evidence I was talking about, it would seem that that's not hopeless. I mean, if you're able to intervene, improve the health, improve the political governance of societies, then they will often be pulled out of poverty. And this has happened in a huge number of countries in the last 50 years.
Yeah. Okay. And then often people say poverty relief is the responsibility of government. They need justice, not charity.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, justice is a more difficult concept to, I suppose, to try and dissect. But if you think that poverty relief in the developing world ought to be the responsibility of governments and not of yourself. I basically had this opinion. And certainly foreign aid is a very large piece of the puzzle. There are some issues with it. It's not always the most effective. But on the whole, it has helped improve developing world health a great deal. And also, in general, most people overestimate quite a lot how much of the government budget is spent on foreign aid. You hear stories of polls. This is in the US, mind you, but I believe that a poll in the US, people on average thought that 25% of the US federal budget was being spent on aid, when over there it's actually under 1%. Yeah. In the UK, we're a little bit more generous, and the proportion is 1.4%. And so, yeah, so this has been fantastic. And for example, smallpox was eradicated mainly through through 4 and 8. But I guess it sort of just goes back to what I was talking about earlier. Once you realize how much of a direct effect and how much of a difference you can make personally by, you know, foregoing essentially a barely noticeable amount of your income, it just really seems to make sense to contribute yourself.
So,
whilst I would like to see more effective government aid, I think being excited about how much of a difference you can make and that you can bring about the end of poverty quicker through your own donations, that's something that motivates me to try and do that.
And then some people say, well, I already give enough. I prefer to invest in my own community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the important things to do if you are an effective altruist is to basically set a giving budget. Because if you're constantly evaluating every purchase you make against the good it could do in the world, that's a recipe for mental illness. So what many effective altruists will do is set a budget. The most common amount is 10% of income. So it's large enough that it definitely has a solid impact. And at the same time, it's small enough that you materially notice it quite little. So if you're already giving to effective charities at a level you're happy with, you already give enough, and that's excellent. And that's all that anybody could ask of you. And as I mentioned earlier, investing in your own community or doing charitable acts which are sort of a bit closer to home, and you get a bit more of the sort of emotional payback from it, is great as well. So by all means, do that also. I think the main crux of it, though, is that replacing effective giving with sort of the local giving or the kind of charity where you really get that emotional reaction to it, is not a good idea, because it really cuts down your actual impact on the world in quite a sizable way. So I think it's important to balance those two, and certainly if you're interested in having a large impact, you know, making sure that you do that first and foremost.
What about people who want to contribute but really struggle to get to the end of the month?
I would say that if you yourself are in financial difficulty, it's perfectly fair to give an amount that you won't notice. There's a fairly common misconception is that, you know, if you give very little, that's so little that it doesn't even make a difference. And so I don't think that's the case. So as an example, if you donate £10 to the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, which is one of the recommended charities by GiveWell and Giving What We Can, that in itself is enough to pay for 25 children in East Africa to be treated for this disease. So when the charity is that effective and so transparent and so well evidenced about what they do, even if you give an amount that's, you know, really doesn't make much of a difference to you, even if you are not the richest person by any stretch, it still has a sizable effect, and it would still seem to be worth doing that.
Okay, so basically every little helps.
Exactly, every little helps.
All right, well then, just the last couple of questions. What resources would you recommend if a person listening were interested in effective altruism?
Sure, so one of the co-founders of the centre is Will McCaskill. And he has a book coming out about effective altruism, which should be – the idea is for it to be just an easy-to-read introduction to the topic. But this won't be out until next year. So once that comes out, that's going to be your best bet. Before then, there is an effective altruism forum, which is a good place to start to interact with these ideas, which is at – www.effective-altruism.com.
Yep.
And if you're interested in the charity effectiveness research that I mentioned earlier, GiveWell and Giving What We Can are great resources for that. And if the ethics of career choice was something that you may be interested in, then one of the organizations here at the center is 80,000 Hours. Yeah, if you have a look at their website, that's a great resource for all our latest research into how to make career decisions in the most ethical way.
Okay. My final question, Marek, what is your understanding of the middle way and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, sure. So I think the idea of effective altruism that relates quite well to the middle way's ideas of sort of avoiding dogma and that sort of thing, and, you know, trying to make sure that your beliefs and your understanding of the world correlate to the evidence, is something that's sort of known in rationalist and effective altruist circles as sort of being Bayesian after the statistical equation. So the idea being that, you know, you have a good idea and a good model of how the world works, which is based on what you already know, your prior knowledge, your prior assumptions, but then at the same time being fully open to re-examine this, to re-examine your entire worldview in light of new evidence. So how Bayes' theorem in statistics helps you re-evaluate prior probabilities based on new information. Doing this with your own worldview, I think, is important. I think both of us would agree on that. Sort of not identifying yourself with your beliefs and your beliefs as being fixed things, which you will hold on to in spite of evidence to the contrary, and then potentially even wearing your resistance to change your mind as some sort of a badge of honor. You know, I have faith or something like that. I'm so stubborn, I believe something and nothing can change my mind about it. You know, basically being dogmatic.
Yeah.
It's, you know, if there is evidence that you can have a great impact by doing something, you should probably abandon your old model of the world where you thought you couldn't make a difference. And then at the same time, if new evidence comes along, and, you know, you find out that another intervention or cause is more effective, you know, you shouldn't be so attached and so dogmatic in your old beliefs of how you should change the world, and you're able to just follow the evidence where it leads. I think that's I mean, I may be wrong, but I think that's something that we would agree on.
Yeah.
And additionally, I think the point about all people being equal and sort of not discriminating against helping people you'll never meet and that may be far geographically, and the idea that helping any one person is equally the amount of good it is. I would imagine you would agree with that, but I may be wrong.
I can go for that. Okay, well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Marek.
Likewise.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.